This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
Oh, listen, this is not only going to be informative and entertaining, and I'll tell you that up in front, because if you don't agree with me, you're wrong. I happen to know what the subject is, and I'm acquainted with the guest. But she comes here from the Arizona Interfaith Movement, and you know how I feel about that group. 25 religions, all able to sit down for a dinner together, and no fists, no threats, no explosions, just a whole bunch of respect. What? In this day and age, are you kidding? Yes, and wait till you hear Courtney Lonergan, because she's talking about discrimination in the United States, around the planet. And she's also talking about her professional field. She's an applied cultural anthropologist and a professional facilitator. So why don't we start off with a definition of both of those terms? I mean, I think probably most people know what an anthropologist is without the prefixes, but start at the beginning.
Okay. So, yeah, anthropology is the study of people and how we relate to each other.
Or don't.
Right.
and an applied cultural anthropologist, does that neutralize the definition that you gave me just now?
No, I would say applied means now in our current society. In our current groups, our cultures, our society, really getting into the ins and outs of what we're up against currently.
And when businesses are up against an absence of profit, that's when they call a professional facilitator.
Perhaps.
Well, if business people have not done that, who are listening right now, tell them what it is that you do in that capacity.
Also to build the collective spirit, teamwork. Bring together people in participation, inspired action.
You're one of those people with a whiteboard, right?
Actually, I have a sticky wall. It's blue.
Oh, yeah. a sticky wall for graphics?
Well, I do graphics, but it's sticky, and so you can move paper around on it, and it's participatory. So people actually write their own ideas, put them up. We see how they connect and synthesize with other ideas. So it's highly engaging.
And you actually get people in the same business, in the same, sometimes the same office, to listen to one another?
Oh, yeah.
What an exciting concept that is.
I know. Hey, I even did one with Central Arizona Project on how to buy and share water over the next 50 years.
Oh.
So even diametrically opposed ideas went in the same group, and then they were working together on it. So it's really powerful.
And no fist fights.
No, no.
Wow.
Yeah, but heated discussion.
Yeah, well, I know, yeah. And yeah. I love the idea, though, that out of the exchange of ideas comes fruitful something.
Yeah.
But have you ever done this with politicians?
Politicians at the table, but not all politicians.
Well, I mean, are you are you able to sit in a room or stand in a room with your sticky wall?
Yes.
And actually get people, even in the same party, to listen to you, to listen to one another, and to actually contribute without weaponry?
Oh, yeah. I originally was using these methods in communities that had gangs.
Where?
Also, in South Phoenix, in the Murphy neighborhood. Uh-huh. We had a positive youth development grant through the federal government, and that's where we worked with 100 youth from 4 schools who had in their families a history of gang involvement, and none of these kids went into gangs. They created their own healthy community, culture, and group.
Wow. Yeah. I'm impressed already.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, facilitating just seems to be something I don't hear about around the Capitol building in Washington.
Oh, yeah.
What's the problem? Is it that they don't have individual facilitators to get them to sit in a room and look at a sticky wall, or is it that their goals are different than the business people you talk to?
I'd say their goals are similar. I mean, I work with a lot of governments and nonprofits. I think perhaps it's having a neutral facilitator, a person that doesn't have a vested interest in either side.
Ooh, in Washington.
Yeah.
Well,
that's what they need.
That could be a full-time job, just finding one of those.
Yeah.
And along with all of those other things, along with the title Applied Cultural Anthropologist and Professional Facilitator, Courtney Lonergan, what an Irish name that is.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I mean, John Patrick Michael McMahon talking to Courtney Lonergan. But I'm the predictable one with the Irish Catholic background. Courtney Lonergan is a Muslim.
Well, I also have the Irish Catholic background.
And when did you become a member of Islam?
In college, graduate school.
Why?
Well, I'd always been on a path of discovery about different religions and majored in anthropology. And my grandmother told me I was to be a nun as the oldest granddaughter in the Irish Catholic family. And so I had a nun as a fourth grade teacher. And I told her, I was like, I'm going to be a nun too. And she was like, well, first, you need to learn about other faith traditions. So I think she really pushed me to broaden my understanding.
But what was it in particular? Because, I mean, growing up as an Irish Catholic, in an Irish Catholic family, I can certainly see and know many people who found other expressions of faith to be attractive. But the Muslim faith is pretty dramatically removed from Catholicism, isn't it?
That's not what I found.
Well, tell me about that, though.
Yeah, I really feel like it's a continuation.
What do you mean?
Well, I originally learned about Islam through college buddies that were a Nation of Islam, and they were reading the Quran at that point in time, and so I wanted to read it, too. As I was studying difference, power, and discrimination, these friends of mine were very powerful and very strong in their identity, and so I really wanted to get into what made them tick.
Where did you go to school?
Oregon State.
Because Nation of Islam also had strong ties to the Valley of the Sun.
Oh, I know.
With Louis Farrakhan.
Yeah. Khalil Sultan settled down here, and he's one of my mentors. He's an amazing human being.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Louis Farrakhan has been on the show a couple of times.
Oh.
And a very interesting, a very challenging guest.
Yeah.
As would have been Malcolm X. I missed having the opportunity to invite him to the show.
I would ask Khalil about Malcolm X. He was one of his advisors.
I've read.
Yeah.
So you have often focused academically on the world of discrimination, too.
Yes.
Explain to our audience in what capacity.
Well.
As you studied all of the things that you've studied, discrimination seems to be something that you've looked at critically.
Yes, and particularly in the United States. Out of a whole group of people that were getting their master's at Oregon State, they were focusing on other cultures and other places. And I was like, what about here? We got a lot going on here. And I was raised in Alaska. And so my image of the lower 48 was this beautiful, diverse, because of the Olympics. And I'd be like, wow, an American? You can never tell who they're going to be based on their external presentation because we're so diverse. And then I went to undergraduate school in Idaho, and it was like a wake-up call. And so I was like, oh, this is what I really got.
And in particular, Idaho.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even their flag is white. it is not a critical observation.
Yeah.
It's just like so many Western states.
Yeah.
Other than the original indigenous people, those that have moved here, people of color and people from different backgrounds, usually have moved from some distance.
Oh, yeah. 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 And I definitely studied Native American. That was my undergraduate focus, was focusing on the indigenous people of the lands.
Wow. Even coming from Alaska, where there are so many influences that you have culturally from the indigenous people there.
Oh, yeah. My mom was inducted into a Native Alaskan tribe, the Inuit, when I was like in kindergarten. And I remember being on a teeter-totter with the chief's son And I was bigger than him. And you have a lot of power when you're bigger than a person on a teeter-totter. And
particularly if it's a guy.
Right. Well, I think if you're heavier, then you kind of control it. You could be mean if you wanted to be as a kid.
Yeah.
And I was being really nice. And he came up to me. And my mom had done a lot for to start the community college in Anchorage, Alaska. And he said, "My gift to you is that you're not white. You're an Alaskan." And it shifted my perspective. It gave me some grounding.
Tell our audience again that word. Share with them that word that you used to describe the name of the tribe.
It's Inuit.
Not Eskimo.
No. That's an external term. Yeah.
Right. That's from us.
Right.
Do you have any idea where that came from?
I've heard different things. I don't know if they're particularly true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Inuit has a kind of cultural dignity to it.
Yeah.
Eskimo is a funny name.
Yeah.
But you had the opportunity to become close to those indigenous people. Do you think that helped you in your perspective?
Yes. Yeah. I think so many of these external labels that we are given are arbitrary. And that's what, you know, I found out in anthropology, is that the terms that we have towards our skin tone are just made up. There's actually 12 phenotypic traits we have that make us different. And
12, say that word again. 12 what?
Phenotypic
what
traits.
What does that mean?
Well, it's like our melanin, which affects our skin tone and our eyes, our hair form. It's whether we have dry earwax or sticky earwax. Now, if you're going to just choose one, like earwax, you could break us into groups. And that's all they did to break us into racial groups, was just focus on melanin. If you would look at all 12 phenotypic traits, there'd be no way to break us into groups, because we're so varied. We are one human race, and we have a lot of distinctions, but we're still one group.
You look so Irish that if you were walking down the street, and I visited Ireland a lot and will go again, but if you were walking down the street in any little village or a city like Galway, there would be no question that you belonged there and probably were raised somewhere down the street. But you're a Muslim.
Right.
You're a practicing Muslim. So in either of those capacities, because certainly Ireland has had its own violent areas of discrimination during the Troubles, but have you ever personally experienced discrimination?
Yes.
Would you tell me about it?
Sure. I mean, you could say as a woman, I've definitely...
But that's an area of discrimination
right. That
happens with half of our population.
Correct. Yeah. I wore a headscarf before 9/11. I started wearing a headscarf in April, and then 9/11 happened. And so I definitely did experience what it was to be a Muslim woman wearing a headscarf in this country. You know, my mom, she was like, "Take it off. Use common sense." I'm like, "I'm not afraid of other human beings." And, you know, here in Phoenix, we were one of the largest refugee relocation areas, and I was working in inner city neighborhoods. And I was like, wow, there's women who wear headscarves who may not speak English or feel comfortable with our culture. I felt like that was part of my journey, was to, I definitely wasn't going to take off my headscarf then. It empowered me to wear it and to engage with Americans and help to break down fear.
And you don't tell anybody named Lonergan what to do with her headscarf.
Right.
Now, did you do it as an element of pride, or, be honest with me,
Was
there a little of that Irish, "You can't tell me what to do, I will wear what the hell ever I want to wear"?
Oh, yeah, that was definitely in certain circles where, you know, I'd go up to ladies, Muslim ladies in the grocery store, and I'd say, "Assalamu alaikum, you know, I'm a Muslim, I pray 5 times a day," and they'd look at me like, "You're just some crazy white girl." You know, I'm an anthropologist. I wanted to, you know, I went to the mosque and I stood out because I didn't wear a headscarf. So I was like, all right, I can do this. I can put a piece of fabric on my head. No, it was rainbow or tie-dyed. And sometimes
even the Muslim ladies in the hajibs were making some kind of a statement separating you from the possibility of being a part of their faith.
Oh, yeah. And then, you know, 9/11 happened, so they thought I was an undercover FBI agent in the mosque. So, you know, I was kind of isolated. But with my kids, I would have them go around and hug and greet every person, which would take some time. I feel like the American Muslims could really help to host and break down fear and a victim mindset that they had about the broader American community. I mean, America is what allowed me to learn about different faiths and to choose the faith that I identify with.
Why aren't you wearing a headscarf now?
Well, I had a Saudi Arabian couple live with me for a couple of years, and they were much more fluent in Arabic. You know, I'm not fluent in Arabic. I read an English translation of the Quran. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, so where does it say to wear a headscarf? And actually, headscarf is kimar in Arabic.
What is hajib?
Hijab. Oh, yeah, maybe you're saying it better. You're probably saying it with a better.
No, probably I'm selling it. I'm probably saying it.
Hijab.
Like an American who doesn't speak Arabic. Is it spelled H-A-J-I-B?
Well, yeah, it's, you know, it's a phonetic transcription of Arabic because they have a different alphabet. So, yeah, I've seen it in different spellings.
How about if I just call it garment?
Yeah, well, it actually means cover, and it means to dress modestly.
Mm-hmm.
So different cultures can choose different paths.
So what about the couple, the Saudi Arabian couple, and the answer to why you're not wearing the headscarf?
So they said it doesn't say that in the Quran. It says kimar, and there is a verse that says, take off your kimars and cover your bosoms. Because women used to flash men as they'd go off to battle. And I was like, what? Because particularly the period of time that I wore the headscarf after 9/11, it really isolated me from my culture. I mean, I remember once being in Olive Garden restroom and having a lady pull her daughter away from me. And I'm like, oh, I'm one of the friendliest, nicest ladies you'll ever meet. And so anyway, that day I took off my headscarf. I was like, it doesn't define me. And, you know, there is a piece where some people do feel like it fulfills their path. And it just limited me from engaging with my broader community. I never had a problem with it. I didn't have to do my hair. I just throw on a headscarf and go.
But isn't it interesting that the answer to my question has taken on so many different arenas of response? Because you were talking when I said, have you personally experienced discrimination? You started by saying, well, yes, as a woman. And then you told me about the discrimination that you've experienced as a Muslim from non-Muslims, from Muslims, from moms in the bathroom. Is it something, and I'm asking you this now, because you're a practicing anthropologist. Do you find, after all of your studies of man, that it's something inherently flawed in us as Homo sapiens? Is there something elementally a part of our character or lack of character, our fear, any of those things that causes us at some time or another in virtually every culture of the world to feel discriminated about and to feel discriminatory toward? Why do we do it?
I'd say it's based out of fear and ignorance.
So every culture is guilty of ignorance.
Yeah.
Have you ever found in your broad range of studies a culture that exists now or any time in the past that has been free of discrimination? You have time.
I think small groups. I think local groups of people. I think maybe neighborhoods, villages where people get to know each other over time and have deep relationships. They can start to address their discrimination. They can start to own their bias, and they can check themselves before they move forward and hurt others or maybe put their foot in their mouth.
But you're just talking about 12 people in a cul-de-sac. You're talking about...
That's where it starts.
Okay, but you're not talking about a complete culture. Not even an entire island
Oh, I don't know. Maybe, perhaps.
Now, why did you just all of a sudden light up?
Well, I've had these mentors who have traveled around the world in every time zone. They're the ones that really put together the processes that I use in large groups by studying indigenous communities. And I've heard about some of the really small islands and how beautiful the cultures are.
Well, I'm glad I brought that up.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, as nice as Phoenix is, an island sounds nice. Yeah. Maybe we could make arrangements, all of us, and go. No, see, if we did, we would change them.
Yeah. And the struggle here, struggle allows for creativity, that work needs to be done, and that work is inspiring.
You're in the inspiring business, aren't you?
Yes.
You seem to really be happy doing what you're doing and being you.
Yeah.
Is that too broad a reach?
No. It's work, right? To get to know yourself. I was reading something that says you need to have three principles or you don't have any. And so I was like, what are my principles? My three main focus, and I heard it another way yesterday. I can't remember how the lady said it, but my three are to be the best mother I can be the best facilitator I can be, and spread love and peace in the earth.
How old are your kids?
They're just 16, 15, and 11.
Do they buy into that?
Yeah. Well, I told them the world is already overpopulated, and the reason I had them was to change the world. So they, they've always had that on their heads.
that's really good. Yeah. You're not here so we can have more of you.
Right.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Just the best of you.
Right.
Now you're here to explain something. As in this room, anyway, this studio, perhaps even this building, our leading authority on Muslim faith, I'm only obligating you in this studio and this building, down the street,
yes,
maybe somebody else.
Right.
But I ran across this, and you see, we're here to talk about discrimination, and we're here to talk about you and your unusual capacity as a former Irish Catholic, now a Muslim, who does a lot of motivational work. Motivating businesses and motivating social groups. So, since I absolutely never have pretended to be an authority on any scripture that has ever been written as a holy book, I happened to run across this about a week ago, and I said, you know what? When Courtney's in the studio, I'm going to ask her about this. Because since the program has to do with eliminating, as best we can, discrimination, this is about the days of Thomas Jefferson. And Thomas Jefferson, one of his most historic confrontations was with the Barbary pirates. I don't know whether you know about that part of it, but from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, the marine hymn. Well, Tripoli was a part, and still is, a part of the world of Islam. And so when the pirates, the Barbary pirates, who happened to be Muslims, were boarding the other ships that were in seas, even reasonably close to the land that they were guarding, there was real conflict going on. And when Thomas Jefferson was the president, a whole bunch of people said from other countries and ours, hey, Tom, what are we going to do about this? Because all of these different navies and merchant ships, mostly merchant ships, were being attacked and scuttled by the Barbary pirates, unofficially representing Muhammad. So this was a quote that was sent to Washington. Ambassador Sidi Haji Abdul Rahman Aja answered their request that the piracy stop. He said, Islam was founded on the laws of their prophet, that it was written in the Quran that all nations who should not have acknowledged their authority were sinners, that it was their right and duty to make war upon them wherever they could be found, and to make slaves of all they could take as prisoners, and that every Muslim who should be slain in battle was sure to go to paradise. Now, I don't know whether that is an accurate quote, because it's an ambassador quoting the Quran, but we hear quotes directly from the Quran in contemporary times from people who have embraced Muslim or Islam or are from Muslim families. And it's one of the areas of confusion. If you are not a Muslim, it seems that many people believe this comes from the Quran. If you are not a Muslim, then I can kill you, either in battle or just simply because you are an infidel. I know you must have been asked things like this in the past, because the challenge is not going to come as often to someone who is Tunisian or whose origin is Saudi Arabian. But when you are a former Irish Catholic woman and you say, no, I'm a Muslim, I know that people have said to you, you believe in the Quran? But the Quran demands that, and then they say things like this. What do you say back?
Well, I'd say the Quran has an androgynous perspective, a man's perspective, and a certain cultural perspective upon it. And the original Arabic, like I've gotten to work with linguists as part of the Muslim Reform Movement, an imam that also studied many languages. And have you heard the quote or the saying that if a Muslim dies a Moor, that they get 70 virgins?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So the term for virgins is originally in the Quran actually means dates, like juicy dates and raisins. And it was used as slang hundreds of years later as the word virgin. But that's not what it means.
With all the stand-up jokes that people have done about the virgins when the soldiers of Islam go to paradise.
There's a piece that attracted me to Islam about that there's no judgment of another human being, that it's no human being's place to judge another human being.
Which is in conflict with what at least non-Muslims believe is in the Quran, saying that you as a Muslim must judge negatively everyone who isn't.
Right. Yeah, and that's not what I choose to do. There's also a piece about struggling against those who oppress you. And I feel like that's what most of our civil rights leaders have done. Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and you can struggle in a nonviolent way. You're actually perpetuating the violence if you, if you're using anger. And so I have many transliterations of the Quran. And one of my favorite ones is from the African American community. And in that one, it says, struggle against those who oppress you. And we do need to struggle against oppression. Now, you find some that are translated from Saudi Arabia, and they say, struggle against those who oppress you. And then in parentheses, it says Christians and Jews. And that's made up.
Well, you see, I really have to jump in and say it isn't unique to the Quran either.
Yeah. That's true. That's very true.
I'm not saying this just because you happen to be here, because I have no interest in making friends with the guests who come in.
Right.
most often they are friends when they leave, but not because we fawn.
Yeah.
But the Bible has so many different areas that ministers and priests and the rabbis who translate the Old Testament and those scriptures, so many times they say, well, but that isn't what it meant when it was originally written, because this word actually meant this, which changed it totally. And it seems to be applicable to all holy books.
Oh, yes, most definitely.
Or maybe all writing.
Right, because even when we have an experience, you and I could have a similar experience and we could take it in different ways, have different versions, different stories, different things we even notice about that experience.
What do you find, as you have studied both, that is the relationship, if one exists, between anthropology and religion?
Well, anthropology does study religion. It's one of the institutions that human beings have made up. I'd say anthropology studies political systems, social systems, cultural, economic, all the different ways human beings relate with each other.
You think there's anthropology? Excuse me. I was a speech major, which does not necessarily allow me to pronounce anthropological correctly all the time. Is there an anthropological value in religion, according to the book of Courtney?
Yes. I feel like organized, institutionalized religion can lead people off the path of true spirituality, in that they are looking to other people and organizations that quite often are imperfect as their guidance, rather than striving to do what's best in the moment, which is our true power.
I read an interesting quote just a couple of days ago. A person named Emil Durkheim said, "Science heals. Religion teaches us how to suffer." Hmm. That was an anthropologist, by the way, I believe, that said that.
Yeah.
But when you look at it, you realize how many elements of suffering, guilt, all of those things are related to organized, institutionalized religion. I think that has merit.
Yes, yeah. That was another thing that attracted me to Islam, was that there wasn't a clergy, that there's no person between you and your spiritual experience. So imam is meant to be teacher. All these fatwas are made up.
That's also what rabbi means.
Oh.
Rabbi
yes,
means
yes.
teacher. Uh-huh. So the imam, though, in our nearest mosque, for example, is not the leader of the service?
Oh, he probably is. Yeah.
You say coquettishly.
Yeah. He thinks he is. Yeah. He's made himself to be.
Oh, well, wait a minute.
So,
what do you mean by that?
Human beings are driven by our egos.
Including clergy?
Most definitely. I mean, when you're in a power position, you need to check yourself. And it's a big responsibility to be over a group of people's spiritual path. I would not choose to be in that position. And I think it would be a struggle.
Religions and cults. That comes up so often. I was just in the local chapel of Scientology. And we had a meeting there of the Arizona Interfaith Movement just a week ago. And Scientology is one of the 22, 23, 24 religions that are part of the interfaith movement. They are among those people who do not get into fights when there's a big dinner. I always use that as an example, because when you have people with turbans and people with Roman collars and people with conservative Protestant suits and they're not screaming at one another, that's unusual.
Yeah, that's why I love that group as well.
So I was in the Scientology chapel, and it occurred to me that it is thought of by many non-Scientologists as a cult. There are also many non-Mormons who consider that a cult. By way of definition, it is a gathering, sharing spiritual thought, following the leadership of a single individual. Oh, but wait a minute. That could also be the Catholic Church. So do you think as a result of your study of anthropology and all cultures and all groups, that maybe all religions have cult qualities?
Yeah. Yeah.
She says, with an immediate degree of certainty. Yeah. Why?
Trying to fit in with the group, you know, and there's a sense of control and power. When groups get large, we tend to be disconnected. I mean, I've had experiences with many different faith traditions where you can pick up on those elements. I have a story. I met with an imam here in Phoenix, and I was starting to do some work with Zudi Jasser around the Muslim Liberty Project.
Regular guest here.
Yeah. And the imam pulled me aside and pulled me into a room and shut the door, which you're really not supposed to do within the Muslim tradition. And he told me that he was worried about my soul working with him.
With Dr. Jasser?
Correct.
Why?
I know. I wanted to know why, too.
Well, yeah, because this is a man who actually, though he doesn't proselytize and do missionary work, he's an example of the highest possible quality of the moderate Muslim of the world.
Right. Yeah, he's a tremendous human. And I barely knew him at that point. I had been hired as a neutral facilitator to lead a process with youth where they bridged their Muslim and American identity. And I said to the imam, "You don't know me. You don't know my soul. You don't know who I am and where I'm from. How could you even pretend to say that you know anything about the choices I'm making?" And he did. He had to settle down. And I met with him later after we had the Muslim Reform Movement Declaration. And he bashfully said, "Yeah, I'm sure we have some people in our community that would ascribe to these thoughts."
But Dr. Jasser has actually said on the air, so I'm not quoting him in his absence, he has said on this program that there have been times in his mosque when he has been criticized sorely for the moderate identity,
yes,
of his expression,
yes,
of Islam. Isn't that sad?
It is. And that's what lets us know there's a problem.
Is it a problem just simply of humankind?
Yes, it is a struggle for all of us within all of our faith traditions to not feel like we're better, to try to understand others' experiences, to empathize with the different journeys that we have, to know that we don't have all the answers.
We're recording this broadcast, no matter when you hear it, and it could be years in the future when all of these problems may have been solved. We like to think.
Yeah, that would be beautiful.
Ideally. But we're recording this the week of the anniversary of 9/11. How do you explain that horrible incident in mankind, not just in the United States?
Oh.
Just the planet.
Yeah. It's a victim mindset.
What does that mean?
It means you don't feel empowered of your life and your experiences and your choices, and you want to blame others for your circumstances. And when you're in that place, you can be violent and hurt others out of that disconnection with your own self and experience.
So you're talking about not only the guys that took the planes, but you're talking about some of the poverty-stricken kids in Chicago who decide that the only alternative that they have is get a gun and shoot people.
Correct. It's very
similar. Is it the same?
It is. That's why after I worked with gangs, I was like, wow, we can protect America from the inside and also from the outside. So that's why I've been driven to do the work with the Muslim reformers. I feel like their work is very important. But also, I mean, there's extremists in other faith traditions as well that would need to address.
Oh yeah, there's that Inquisition thing. We must acknowledge the fact that that Christians are not free from practicing terrible things against humankind.
Yeah. Yeah, and that not to minimize the importance of the Muslim reform movement right now. We're definitely at a pivotal stage where a lot of change could happen.
Talk about that organization.
Muslim leaders and imams, activists who acknowledge that there is extreme rhetoric within the Muslim community, and they're working to address it and to bring along other Muslims on the journey. And many are already there.
Are there a frightening number of fanatics in the Muslim world?
In my experience, most of the Muslims that I meet are moderate. They may not have the personal courage to stand up against the institutions. Many Muslims don't go to the mosque. I would say that you would find more extreme folks hanging out in the religious institutions.
But where does Al-Qaeda come from? Where does ISIS come from? Who are these people and why? And here's the question I've never had answered. Why does an organization like ISIS attract some kid from East LA to get on a plane and join this grubby organization out in the middle of a sand pit?
Yeah. I think it's through a loss of humanity in our broader culture, and people are looking to be a part of something that's greater than what they are. And that story gives them that. And they have the funding. If you were to give any gang that had a victim mindset and had some charismatic leader that's going to make a bunch of promises, and they have the money to back it up, they can be powerful.
So you think of ISIS as just a huge gang?
Correct.
And Al-Qaeda?
Yeah.
And they come from circumstances that are similar in what way?
It's an ideology. It's a mindset. It's the victim mindset and blaming others. And it's also arrogance. I would say it's a superiority complex. It could be based on race, feeling that you're group, your culture is better than others.
Oh, you mean the white supremacist groups in America?
It's the same thing as Arab supremacy. Yeah.
That's a very, very interesting parallel and metaphor. Mm-hmm. Because I really have to believe that white supremacists could not possibly feel any more distant from members of ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Those brown-skinned people in the garbs that the white supremacists don't recognize at all and would consider, I have no doubt, to be totally the enemy.
Yeah, and they're very similar. And they operate out of ignorance and fear. You know, back in the day, I used to call the MMM. It's the same as the KKK. It's the messed up Muslim movement.
Excuse me. MMM. I'm writing it down.
Yeah.
And I think I possibly might share that with Zudi Jasser the next time he's on. The studies that you've made religiously and anthropologically are fascinating to me, because it does really get down to the most basic elements of everything that we live with, and that is each other. The study of anthropology, as you said early in the show, is the study of us.
Yeah.
Man. But have you gone so far back that you can acknowledge the fact that discrimination took place as long ago as the beginnings of man?
Hmm.
When was the first time that you recall studying areas of discrimination, group against group, individual against individual, religion against religion? Can you remember?
Well, I think I've been an observer for a while, and so I could see how people treated each other differently. I picked it up in my neighborhood when I was a kid, you know, older kids versus younger kids, adults and the way they treat young people in groups and out groups. I've witnessed that my whole life. You know, I was reading an article, the three things that make human beings different than other species. I don't know if it was in Time magazine or something, but you know, I read a lot. One was our capacity to control fire. Two was our capacity for speech. And the third was our capacity to build shelter. And shelter allows for creativity. And I think, you know, you could think about shelter in a metaphorical way as well. That if you have a stress-free home, I mean, it's hard to be stress-free, but I feel like stress is the big four-letter or five-letter word that we have to overcome to live a stress-free life. You can have more creativity and more peace, which then allows you to be aware and not, I mean, we are different. Each person is different. And to want them to be the same isn't acknowledging their experience. My daughter once, we live in downtown Phoenix. There's a lot of people, a lot of homeless people that come through in our neighborhood. And as we walk to school on the bridge, there's people that have slept there that night. And my daughter said once when she was little, she said, oh, I feel bad for them. And I said, don't feel bad for them. That means that you think that you're better. Who knows what part of this journey they're in? Be here in the moment. Maybe smile at them. Let them sleep. If they ask you for water, it takes a lot to ask someone for help. Give them something that they ask for. But try to be connected on the journey rather than judge.
I wish we could put all of that on a bumper sticker for cars. It would be a very large bumper. Yeah. But what a lesson, just simply the kindness of what you're just saying. Because that same area where you live, when I moved here back in the 1700s, it was called the Deuce. I don't know whether you've ever heard
of it. Oh, I know that. You're talking about that. I know what the Deuce is. Yeah, it's like a restaurant?
Well, actually, it's a restaurant now.
Okay.
That is called that because the neighborhood was the Deuce. And you didn't walk through the Deuce at night comfortably.
Oh, I've ridden my bike through there, yeah.
But still, we're talking about a very different downtown than in the 60s.
Yeah.
It wasn't because of an enormous amount of violence. It was just the faint smell of Muscatel permeated the air. And the people were homeless and living outside. And there were panhandlers.
Yeah.
You don't see too many of those in Scottsdale or Paradise Valley. But in the Deuce, you had that kind of plateau of privilege, for lack of a better phrase. All the different levels of haves and have-nots. And the haves may have inherited the have part, or they may just have worked their butts off and had an opportunity that they took. The people who were the have-nots that were sleeping outside, you don't know why they were there, but we discriminated against many of them because what did we call them? Lazy bums. Lazy bums. We didn't have any idea whether they were mentally ill, as a disproportionate number of them are.
Yeah.
Didn't have any idea about illness, tragedies in their lives, no matter what. Lazy bum.
I had a student once that was homeless, and he heard that term used towards him, and he said, when I was homeless, he goes, there was nothing lazy about it. He said, I was constantly moving, figuring out where my next place would be, where I'd get water, where I'd get food. It was a very active process. He actually felt he could relax much more having his shelter.
I come to you for the brilliance of your background. So you see, if you give me an answer, you could be taking me in, and I have no idea whether it's true or not. But you speak eloquently, so I'm convinced.
Well, I'm striving to tell the truth with the best of my capacity.
Well, it's also one of the reasons we invited you, because we don't just pick up folks in the parking lot to come upstairs. Although the people in the parking lot are perfectly nice people, too. Yeah. the different religions that we have and biological anthropology, the pairing of those two seems to be constant in history. Why? All of these different religions, even the different sects of Christianity and the Muslim faith, and peaceful Buddhists and not so peaceful Buddhists. The Buddhists are physically and violently keeping the Muslims out of Myanmar. Mm-hmm. And that is a horrible war that's going on there. And the aggressors are the Buddhists that we always associate with rice bowls, saffron robes, and prayer wheels.
Yeah. Our traditions, how they're passed down.
Yeah, all the different religions we have in the world, and biological anthropology, doesn't one have often something to do with the other?
Yes, most definitely.
Talk about that.
Well, the way the traditions are passed down is also influenced by the broader culture and by the individuals. And if it's passed down with a lens of fear and ignorance and hate, then that also becomes a part of the tradition.
And power too?
Yeah. Whoever has power in that situation, and it's personal power too. You can't empower another person. Even a young person could sense in their being that this wasn't right, that this was unjust, and they can choose a different path.
Not if you're in Iran.
Right. Their journey may be very short.
And the Ayatollah.
Right.
I've talked to Iranian young people who seemed as if they were just right out of a dance club in Scottsdale. They wanted to date, hold hands in the park, neck a little bit, for lack of a better term, and go to school and get an education, then eventually wind up married. It was the same story that we have.
Yeah.
But the Ayatollah, a religious and political figure, mm-hmm. with incredible power, said, that isn't the way we do things. So here's your faith. Is that the misapplication?
Yeah, who's he to judge? Why is he in charge? He's just a human being. We're each here to have our own experience. And every person has wisdom if their spirit hasn't been crushed.
But should nobody be in charge of religions? Should there be no pope? Should there be no Archbishop of Canterbury?
That's why I was attracted to Islam, because there wasn't a religious clergy. That's why when someone told me they were, I said, well, not in my perspective. I mean, I'm going to respect them as a human being, but they don't know the inner workings of my heart.
Do you feel any sense of optimism at all about the future of understanding?
Most definitely.
In the United States?
Oh, yes.
Why?
Because we have such a beautiful, diverse population, and we can engage with each other. Democracy is not something that's on paper. It lives in the hearts of the people, and it starts one-on-one. If you really think about it, grassroots organizing is really the only thing that changes anything. Think about the women's rights movement, the civil rights movement. People, person to person, people to people, people gathering together on what they're inspired to do, what they're inspired to change, and it's building one brick at a time, one step at a time. It's not how you get started, it's just getting started.
Your adrenal gland just grew about 5 pounds just talking about that, because you are an activist, aren't you?
Yes, for humanity.
But you're not letting other people just do it.
No. You know, Gracie Lee Boggs, she's one of my favorite authors out of Detroit, and she wrote a book, The 21st Century Revolution. She says it's going to happen in this country, and it's going to, what we're going to do is we're going to regain our humanity. That just because you were born human doesn't mean you know how to treat another person as a human being.
21st century revolution, does that mean with guns?
No, it's with hearts.
See, wherever there's ever been a revolution that I can think of, the overthrow of a government, that kind of thing, it's always done with weapons.
A young person, she was like 4 years old, one of my neighbor girls, her name's Akshaya. When she was young, she said, "What's your New Year's revolution going to be?" I was like, well, I'm not going to correct her. That's beautiful.
Tell me how people can get in touch with the organization that you referred to before. Is it the American Muslim?
Oh, the Muslim Reform Movement?
Excuse me, yes.
Yeah, yeah. The Muslim Reform Movement, you can just look that up, MuslimReformMovement.org. They got a Facebook page where they got dialogue and a website. Also, yeah. The Arizona Interfaith Movement. We have Experience Interfaith coming up October 24th. It's a beautiful event.
And wait a minute, listen. Arizona Interfaith Movement, you want to hear who you're meeting? Baha'i, Buddhist, Christian, Falun Dafa, Hare Krishna, Hindu, Islam, Jain, Jewish, New Thought, Scientology, Sikh, Sufi. And those are just the ushers that will get you to your seat for the Arizona Interfaith Movement.
Yeah, and humanist secularists, agnostic, atheists, everybody.
All I can tell you is the seats here are at no cost whatsoever. This is called The God Show, and we open the doors every day on the Star Worldwide Network.